Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
Today, birds and plants.
Actually, trees and plants and vegetable gardens.
That's right.
You're so stuck in the fame of David Sibley and his bird association.
That's right.
You flaked out and forgot.
Oh, I did that intentionally.
It's his tree identification.
I don't
book.
Do flaking out. You know that.
But yeah, David Sibley has written a book, Sibley's Guide to Trees.
Yeah. And it really is a good book. It can be read at any level. And I've never really gone out in the woods with a book in silence and tried to figure out what was out there. But this book, I think you could do it.
Uh-huh. Because it's hard to identify trees, especially in the wintertime.
Exactly. But I think, you know, this is a book can be written at many different levels. And, of course, he is the bird expert.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned all his abilities and his wonderful painting and his craft and his depth of knowledge to trees.
Yeah.
It's a fun book to
It's a great book.
To go through.
It looks like a fabulous resource. I'm
yeah.
very excited. And then we're going to talk to Cheryl Long. It's been a couple years since we've talked to Cheryl, but Cheryl's the editor of Mother Earth News.
Yep.
And they've got some great resources for, for any vegetable gardener, really, Bob, but especially for beginners. If you're not really sure what to plant, when to plant, that sort of thing. They've got these charts and these guides that sort of assist you. So they've did this survey across the country in terms of the best plants, the you know, where you'll find the most success, basically, in different parts of the country. So you may want to check out their website and, you know, all of that detailed information after hearing what Cheryl has to say about getting your vegetable garden started
yeah, I know.
This spring.
Mother Earth Online, it just tickles my old guy's fancy, I'll tell you that.
I know. Got to keep up with the times, I suppose, huh? So that's coming up today on Homegrown. We hope that you'll stick with us. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Well, I'm kind of a novice bird watcher. You've done it for years. But I just
not really.
Well, I'm so excited about it. I mm-hmm. go out there and look at this gray day and black limbs, these beautiful bright red cardinals,
mm-hmm.
and the blue jays come in there, and then the squirrels are on the ground, and here's these pieces of color floating around in a gray glum world,
mm-hmm.
and I feel good because I'm feeding them. That's the cheap, easy part. But just looking out the kitchen window and seeing those birds is just fun.
It is fun.
It kind of picks me up and keeps me going until Lincoln's birthday, anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Comes up.
And, you know, I've always watched birds, but just kind of like that. I'm no bird watching expert by any means, but
the
I
art.
Think it's just the joy of seeing pretty birds.
The palette out there.
And how
it's
they
terrific.
Jump around and what they do.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's pretty cool.
How about the Wish You State? What's up?
Well, I wanted to update you on no sickness.
Oh, good.
No foodborne illness.
You look all right.
I do look all right. I opened one of my jars of preserved green beans.
Was I there for that one?
No. What did we do this year? We did canning tomatoes.
Yeah, that's
right.
That's right.
And I haven't gotten sick from any of the tomatoes either.
That's good.
But I have this book called The Gardeners of Terre Vivante, which is a French translation. Basically, they collected a whole bunch of old-time ways of preserving food, right?
Right?
Without freezing or canning and all that stuff. So using brines and vinegars, et cetera. Lacto fermentation. I did do some lacto fermentation, but I threw it away because I got afraid.
I'm glad you didn't bring it
plus
in.
Plus, I tasted it, and it didn't taste very good, so I figured why be afraid and not have it taste very good. But success, and I will continue to do this the rest of my life. I canned, in a jar, I should say, preserved some fresh green beans in a salt brine back in August. I opened the jar just several days ago.
And
it's preserved in a salt brine, so you need to rinse, basically just empty the jar out of the liquid, put fresh water in there, let it sit about, a day or two.
I'd hope.
To get the salt out.
Yeah.
Bob, I could not, Andy was kind of freaked out too. They tasted like fresh.
Wow.
It was amazing. So why would anybody ever, cook the daylights out of and can green beans if you can safely preserve green beans fresh, probably more nutrition too is left in them, wouldn't you think?
Yeah.
And this easy salt brine.
I've done Bloody Marys that way.
I'm sure. Have you brined yourself?
Around the rim
yourself
a little bit. But.
But yeah, it was fabulous. And the next jar that I open, I'll try to remember to bring you,
please,
you know, like a little sampling of them so you can taste them as well, because they really were fabulous. I couldn't believe it.
I'm proud of
you. I'm going to do tons more next year.
Okay.
Because I just did a sampling this year because I didn't know what was going to work and what wasn't. You know?
Another case where death will tell you.
Exactly.
Things worked out.
Exactly. All right. Well, speaking of the garden, we're going to continue with Cheryl Long here in a second, but there's some events going on at Thienemann's to get you started sowing seeds and taking cuttings, and it takes place January 29th, 30th, and 31st, you know, for beginning to advanced gardeners. It's a hands-on workshop, you know, to kind of jumpstart the growing season. So check out our website at WFPL.org or call Thienemann's Herbs and Perennials.
Well, it's good to hear that.
Mm-hmm. And I'm getting anxious and excited, and this is the kind of stuff that I think...
Thienemann's a great place to start.
Sends us over the edge, don't you think?
And thinking of planting seeds.
Thinking of planting seeds, Mother Earth News has some information for you. Yeah. Cheryl Long is joining us now. She's the editor of Mother Earth News, the original guide to living wisely. For nearly 40 years, readers have enjoyed information that supports independent living, homesteading, natural health, whole foods, organic farming and gardening, livestock, and more. But today we wanted to talk to Cheryl about the best crops to plant for the Midwest, planting charts, and the economic return on your vegetable garden investment. Cheryl, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure to be with you.
Great. The mission of Mother Earth News and the history of the Shuttleworth starting it back in the 1970s. Huh. Can you give us a little background?
Well, the magazine was launched in 1970, and at that point, the back to the land movement was really getting into full steam.
Mm-hmm.
We've been publishing ever since, and we cover organic gardening, but also renewable energy, solar power, all kinds of homesteading topics, and self-reliance.
Mm-hmm. So are you all selling more magazines than ever? Because, you know, back in the 70s, as you said, you know, the movement was sort of in full force. Well, it seems like it's come back around again full force.
It definitely has. We aren't selling as many as we sold at the peak period, but the magazine has been doing extremely well. Both subscriptions and newsstand sales are very strong, and of course that's not true for most magazines right now. So, yes, there's definitely a renewed interest in the topics that we cover.
Now, is Mother Earth online, too? It sounds funny to say that, Mother Earth online. Even, can people go there and get it?
Not only is Mother Earth News online, but we're online in a really big way. We have the entire archive, everything we've ever published in the last 40 years, and this is our 40th anniversary issue, February issue coming up, is online and open and free to the public.
So, well, you know, and it is, because it's like I like getting it in the mail. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I will always do that. So you can count on me as being a subscriber. But can that kind of hurt you if you provide all of the information free for people to access via the internet?
Well, we hope not. We've managed to keep our subscription prices for the print magazine down to just $10 a year, mm-hmm. as long as people renew online. If they go online and renew, and we don't have to send out all the paper mailings, that really helps us. And so we've been able to keep it at $10, which we think is a great bargain.
That's a bargain,
And then, you know, we market other things through the website, so the traffic that comes to the website, then we
can
talk to them
too
about subscribing to the magazine. So that's when we can create a new subscriber from the website, that's very beneficial to us, too, because we don't have to spend all that money and paper again.
So. With the image of Mother Earth sitting in a rocker texting and tweeting, just...
I know, it's, you know, but we got to keep up.
Well,
I know, I know.
Yeah, at least she's not wasting paper, right?
Well, and, you know, it's really very exciting. We now, some months, we have over 1 million people visit our website.
Wow.
And so our audience, our potential audience, and our potential to share the information with so many more people, it's, the, you know, the internet is an amazing thing.
It is. It's what people are using. Well, one way that you have engaged your online readers and your paper readers was to ask them to help rate the best crops around the country. What was the criteria in engaging the best crops to grow around the country?
Well, it was a fairly detailed survey. It took people about 20 minutes to complete it, but we have. About 20,000 of our readers who've agreed to be in these survey groups so that we can send them out a survey online. They can answer the questions. It comes back, and the system automatically helps us tabulate it.
Mm-hmm.
So the criteria were we went through all the different crop categories, and then we just ask a whole series of questions. The survey's up online, and people can read it. But what we were trying to get at, then we could sort that by which part of the country a person was living in, gardening in.
Mm-hmm.
So we have these top crops, the best crops, the crops that do best in those regions, sorted out for all the different regions, and we've posted all that online.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, people go in, they can search our website for top crops, and then they'll see a list of the regions and the top crops. They can pick their region and go in and see what hundreds of other gardeners in their region reported were the crops that grew the best for them, that gave them the best yields. And we had some criteria in there about, do you like it really, do you use it mostly for fresh, do you like it for preserving, and that mm-hmm. sort of thing as
mm-hmm.
well.
I see in the magazine that there was a national top 25 crops, and actually, I think, what would you guess would be the top number one crop, Bob?
Garlic.
He must have looked at my list.
I was astounded, frankly.
I would say tomatoes or something.
And radishes were 25th because I can raise radishes.
Yeah. So national 25. Number one was garlic.
Yeah.
I'm surprised.
Bush snap beans, pole snap beans, slicing tomato, cherry tomato, paste tomato, potato, snow peas, shallot, shell pea, scallion, chard, dry soup bean, sweet pepper, rhubarb, summer squash, spinach, hot pepper, carrot, winter squash, beet, kale, sweet corn, collards, and radish. I would think that tomatoes would be at the top of the
Me
list
too.
No matter what.
Right.
I was surprised by that, too, for the national results. Yeah.
Yeah. So
but for the Midwest, slicing tomatoes was the number one
okay.
choice.
And yeah. I am a Midwest girl, I guess.
Boy.
Yeah. You want me to run off the top 10 for the Midwest?
That would be great. Yeah. Thank you, Cheryl.
Oh, these are the crops that people are saying are the most satisfying and productive and best choices if you grow in that region. And so for the Midwest, it was slicing tomatoes followed by sweet peppers and cherry tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Next was onions, and then snap beans,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and then carrots,
right.
and number seven was garlic, and then the paste tomatoes come in, and then snow and snap peas, and then number 10 was lettuce.
All right.
It was a darn West Coast with the garlic thing, probably.
I suspect that's what pushed it. Although, you know, it is a crop that's just sort of been popularized, I think, over the last decade. It's really, people are really enjoyed growing it. There's been a lot of written about it.
Well, and I think, too, the increased interest in, like, the health benefits of certain foods.
Yes, I think that's right, too, the health side of it, yep.
And it is easy to grow. Because ultimately, these lists, and as you said, you can access them on the website or in the Mother Earth News edition that came out April, May 2009. But ultimately, the list is to help us really be met with success in each area.
Right. That was the goal here, was to try to help people figure out which things they could choose, especially if they're beginning gardeners.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So a good list to follow if you're not so sure what to grow or a little bit nervous about it. Okay, another question, something that you guys have recently done, is follow how much savings one can save if they grow their own food. And remarkably, the headline was $700 worth of produce in 100 square feet.
Yep. Yeah, this was an article that came to us from Rosalind Creasy. Some of your listeners may know her. She's the person who wrote the original edible landscaping book some years back, and she has a new edition of that coming out later this year. So she's a real veteran gardener, but she wanted to really quantify the productivity of the food gardens. And so she took a bed in her yard that was like 5 feet by 20 feet,
yeah,
100 square
small,
feet.
Yeah.
And she just kept track of everything she harvested. She weighed it all and logged it in. And she came up with the pounds of tomatoes and lettuce and I think she had zucchini in there. And then she went and compared that amount of food to the prices that she'd had to pay if she bought it all at the local farmer's market or grocery stores. And that's the result she got, was that $700 was the value that she got from the produce that she grew from one season.
It was $746.52.
Yeah.
She did the math.
And it was even higher. That was California, I believe.
Yeah.
And then she checked the prices her assistant, who was in Iowa, and it was even higher. I think it was $900 there. And these are organic produce prices.
Mm-hmm.
That was amazing. She got 230 servings of salad from her 100-square-foot
plot. Isn't that something? With all the other stuff, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I think salads are hugely productive.
And one day she picked 49 tomatoes, 9 peppers, 15 zucchinis, 3 handfuls of basil, $136 worth of stuff in one day.
Yeah, there you go.
Hmm.
Amazing.
So, yeah, I'm sure you guys are seeing this too, but I think a lot of people are starting to think seriously about trying to do a food garden, even maybe if they haven't before. A lot of different things are feeding into that. I think it isn't just about saving money. I think there's a lot of concern about food safety with all the concerns that we've had with E. coli contamination in the salad greens and so forth. So we're certainly seeing just a great deal of interest in beginning gardeners.
Beginning gardeners, and that's the thing. We kind of want to demystify the difficulty of planting, your own small vegetable garden. I think many of these things do. Cheryl, another resource that you guys have online is a planting chart that kind of holds people's hands, saying, okay, now's the time to plant this, now's the time to plant that, because I think beginners don't necessarily understand that soil temperature relates, to how well something's going to germinate, et cetera.
Yes, we worked these pages up last year, and they're on our website. They're under they can search what to plant now.
Mm-hmm.
And again, these are sorted out by region. So you go to what to plant now, and then you pick your region, and you go in. And what we've provided is a list of all the different crops that people might be choosing to grow, and information on what time of year to plant, what time of the spring to plant them.
Mm-hmm.
We also tell them how to go and get their average last spring frost date, and a lot of times in the gardening literature you'll see this that says plant 2 weeks before your frost date, or 2 weeks after. Well, people don't even quite know what their frost date is, so we've got that information all linked in, and then we've got all of that linked over to basic advice on how to grow each crop, how to plant it, how to space the seeds, which varieties to consider for different qualities that you're looking for, and so forth. So it's kind of, we like to kind of call it our gardening Digipedia, and it all cross-linked. And so I think people will find it a really good resource.
Great.
Mother Earth would love that.
Does
that extend into the fall gardening season too?
It does, yes. We take it all the way through and give some fall planting dates, so forth. We've also got more than just vegetables. I think we've got herbs included.
That's kind of a neglected time of the year, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
people are sick of gardening.
But more and more interest on that. We've been surprised. We survey our story ideas with our readers to decide for sure which material we're actually going to put in the magazine. And fall gardening scored extremely well for us last year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people are realizing that there's another whole season for most of us.
And additionally, I think people are learning how to extend the spring and fall season by using tunnels and other types of techniques.
Absolutely. Lots of discussion of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, as the season begins anew, have you all noticed any sort of trend in home gardening that we should be paying attention to for 2010, Cheryl?
Well, I think the fall gardening,
even
though it's a ways off at this point, but I think the fall gardening, and I think just the huge increase in food gardening, people are breaking up their front yard if they don't have sunshine in the backyard, why they're putting gardens out front. It's a neat time for food gardening. I think we're going to see that continue probably over the next few years.
Yeah, and just by sheer catalog count, my postman gets a hernia carrying in the catalogs anymore. But there's a lot more catalogs now on
there are.
On
there's some new companies, and there's some older companies. That there's some phenomenal catalogs out there.
Oh yeah.
People are interested in heirloom garden seeds, they should be sure to take a look at the Baker Creek heirloom seed catalog, and of course the Seed Savers Exchange in Iowa, the nonprofit group. They have a fabulous catalog. These catalogs are just gorgeous.
I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's encouraging. There's no better time to plan for all this than right now as we try to warm up.
Yeah.
And if you haven't started your own vegetable garden, this year is the year to do it, right?
Right. And by the way, all those catalogs are free. They're virtually all free, and they're not only wonderful fun, but
good
I
resources.
Think they're one of the best ways to learn about gardening.
I do, too.
You learn so much from those catalogs.
I agree.
I'm sorry, the whole ornamental vegetable thing I love. I kind of neglect it, but there's some really pretty red stem this and purple
stem
that.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. And in fact, that's what Rosalind Creasy's new book will be all about, is how to blend the beauty of vegetables right into your overall landscaping.
Mm-hmm. Cheryl, any, I guess, odd disputes or controversies in home gardening that we should be aware of as well? Because I know Mother Earth News tries to stay up on those sorts of environmental concerns.
There's a real concern with herbicide contamination in compost. We did a couple stories on this last year. This happened a couple years back with some of the new herbicides that they came out with that were used on lawns, and they're so persistent that they were persisting in the material even after it was composted, after grass clippings were taken to the municipal compost site, and then people would take that compost and bring it back home, and somehow things wouldn't grow well, and it took a long time to figure out what was going on. And then they took those products off the market, and then we read last year that the same problem had cropped up in England, and then it turned out that the extension agents here in the U.S. were also getting reports. So they can read more about this on our website. I think if they search killer compost, they will probably find reports on that. So what I would encourage people to do is to be really careful as they're bringing in grass clippings or hay or straw from sources, and to ask questions about how it might have been treated, and to be kind of cautious if they're using compost from a municipal site. They might want to bring a little home and plant some peas or beans in it, and make sure they grow okay before they put a whole bunch down in their garden.
Good argument for having your own compost pile out back, too.
Yeah, well, for sure, yeah.
All right, Cheryl, thank you so much. We appreciate
thank
your
you.
Time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Uh-huh. Cheryl Long is the editor of the magazine Mother Earth News, the original guide to living wisely. The magazine is published bi-monthly by Ogden Press, which also publishes Natural Home and Garden, Herb Companion, and Farm Collector. For more information on all of this, of course, you can see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up after the break, after mastering the art of birding, David Sibley turns his attention to identifying trees. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And on to really one of the best tree identification books I'll be able to use.
Yeah.
Because it is difficult to identify trees.
Yeah, and
he's made it more organized somehow in the way that we would think.
It's somehow child-friendly. You can look at the pictures of which he did 4,000 paintings himself.
Yeah.
And identify trees by just using his...
Yeah.
His photographs.
Yeah, like he has done with all of the bird books. Most people are familiar with David Sibley with the Sibley Bird Guides, and now there's a tree guide.
Yep, David Sibley began drawing birds in the early 1960s when he was 7 years old. And 10 years later, he was traveling all over North America on birdwatching tours, journeys that led him to write a half dozen books on birds and birding. What made his journey more complete was just this past year he released a book about the places where birds are often most likely to be found, like trees. He's with us today from his home in Concord, Massachusetts, to talk about that book, The Sibley Guide to Trees, which includes 500 maps covering 600 species and has more than 4,000 paintings. David, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you.
I hadn't thought about this really until reading your book, but birds are found in trees, and you spend a lot of time looking at birds in trees. So is that sort of the genesis of this book, or was it more than that, really?
It was more than that, and I certainly noticed trees, of course. They're what's usually holding up the birds.
Right.
But I think most bird watchers are general naturalists. You want to know the name of everything that you see. So I had always looked at trees and enjoyed drawing them and learning about them. And once I finished the bird guide, I thought about heading off in a new direction with a new topic and another field guide. And for a couple of reasons, trees really jumped out as the best topic for that. One of the reasons is that they're just around us all the time. We see them every day. So if you learn how to identify trees, it's a skill you can put to use every day, wherever you go, much more than, say, learning how to identify butterflies or salamanders or lots of other interesting things, but just the chance to use it every day.
And the fact that we do see certain things every day, I think, sometimes means we take them for granted. So perhaps the, you know, a guide that people can actually follow could reinvigorate them in terms of their interest in things that they see every day.
Yeah, well, yeah, I hope that's true, because I know I certainly just passed by lots of trees without really giving them a second look until I started working on this book, and now, even now, after I've been studying trees intensively for 7 or 8 years, I can still walk along a path that I've been on hundreds of times before and suddenly notice a new tree. Not like it just sprouted overnight, but there's so many things that you just walk by without ever noticing.
Yeah. So, David, can you compare the approach to identifying birds and watching birds with that of identifying trees? Are there similarities that made it kind of a seamless jump for you, or is it quite different, in fact?
There's definitely similarities. And the way I approach tree identification is as a bird watcher. So I'm looking at trees the same way I look at birds. I'm trying to identify them from a distance, at a glance, just based on some overall appearance, and using clues like habitat and even the time of year is a clue that can help you identify a tree, because they change colors just like birds do. They change colors with the seasons. They lose their leaves. They have fruit and flowers at different times of the year. So knowing what to expect each week in terms of the appearance of the trees will really help you to identify them. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of identification clues that just show up for a brief period, a few weeks each year. And that's very similar to bird watching. With trees, you can look forward to the flowering of the red maples in the early springs, one of the first trees to flower, and American elm flowers at about the same time. So when you see an elm flowering in the early spring, you know it's either it's one of several species, American elm, slippery elm, and Siberian elm, but they all have different colored flowers. So the combination of the flowers being there at that time of year, and then the color of the flowers allows you to identify those trees instantly. So that's the way I was approaching it, and it's very similar to bird watching, the same kinds of processing, pattern recognition, and just being alert to all the possibilities.
Well, to that point, what would you say is the biggest difference between your guide to trees and other tree guides?
Well, what I tried to do in this guide to trees was to make a tree field guide that would function the way bird watchers expect a bird guide to work. And that's the simplest way to describe that is just that a modern bird guide is based on pictures. You see something in the field and you flip through the pages of the book until you find a picture that matches what you've seen.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And as you do that multiple times and you gain experience, you get a sense of what a sparrow looks like, what a thrush looks like, what an oriole looks like, and then you can see a bird and go to that section of the book and say, I think it's some kind of oriole or wren, and you look at those species. And the tree field guides in the past had been based mostly on text. Mm-hmm. So you had to go to the book and read, and usually they would lead you through a key and a series of questions. So no matter what had caught your attention in the field, once you opened the book, you had to leave behind what you had noticed and start answering the questions that the book was asking, like, are the leaves opposite or alternate? are the leaves simple or compound, that series of questions. So what I wanted to do was create a tree field guide that would allow people to just go out and notice something interesting on a tree, whether it was leaves or fruit or bright color in the fall or interesting bark or et cetera, and then just flip through the pages of the book to look for a picture that matches. So there's over 4,000 individual illustrations in my tree guide, and that's the idea, is that it's meant to be just a visual catalog. Mm-hmm. And
so Dave, let me interject just really quickly to sort of illustrate that, because I totally get what you're saying, because yeah. I'm the girl that flips through the bird book trying to figure out what the bird is, and vague ideas, you know, similarities, but then you're scratching your head because you're not really sure, and you know there's variables, that sort of thing. So mm-hmm. with the tree, a similar thing. So I could be out, and I could see a tree that has very fluted leaves and think, mm-hmm. well, it kind of looks like a birch, but I'm not really sure, right? So then you go mm-hmm. to the birch family section of the Sibley tree guide. And then you see paper birch, gray birch, and then you see weeping birch, and then you move into the alders, which are a part of the birch family, which also have similarly fluted foliage. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the hop hornbeam, you know, so it's the hazels. So I totally understand what you're saying, and I think that does, in fact, distinguish it from other identification books, because you can go to that one thing that's similar and see the range of options.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And pretty quickly you'll develop a sense of what makes all the birches similar and what makes them similar to the alders and what makes all the oaks similar. Mm-hmm. And so just the way a bird watcher can look at a bird and say, oh, it's some kind of sparrow, you'll be looking at a tree and saying, It's in the birch family.
Yeah, some sort of birch family, yeah.
Similar to that.
Yeah.
Now, you were doing that at age 7, however, which sets you apart from some of us. You talk about you have to practice your observing skills. I think that's correct. And was that so? You think it's a learned trait? Can people actually learn to do that after a while?
Yeah, it's definitely a skill that you can develop. I'm sure it's like most other things, it's probably something that some people are particularly good at, but no matter how good you are naturally, you can still develop that skill, or you have to develop it. I think it's all about recognizing patterns and putting things into context, of learning to notice something that's a little bit out of the ordinary or a little bit outside of the normal range of what you see.
Mm-hmm.
And the more things you see, the more finely tuned your sense of the normal pattern is, and then you get better at recognizing what's slightly different.
Yeah, and you've got, 600 North American species. Did you actually go out and find each one of those in different parts of the country?
I didn't. I saw most of them, probably about three-quarters I saw in the wild. But with this book, there just wasn't... I just ran out of time. I was busy painting and writing, and... didn't have time to go travel around and find all of the different species.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, there was 4,000 paintings in the book. You did all those too, I trust.
Yeah, I did all the paintings.
So, David, how do you go about doing the illustrations? Do you have, you know, your model life, you know, sitting there, and then you paint it, or what?
There were a few of the paintings. A few of the paintings in the guide, I actually carried all my painting supplies and a little stool out into the woods and mm-hmm. sat down and painted a tree on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't practical to do that for very many.
Sure.
So mostly what I did was take digital photos. Well, I should say, for me, sketching and drawing is a big part of the learning process. So in the early years of working on this book, I spent a lot of time in the field looking at trees and doing drawings just to sort of learn how they're shaped and how the twigs bend and fork and how to draw bark patterns and textures. So that was a really important part of the learning process. And then once I had enough experience with that, I could work in the studio just using photographs for reference.
Mm-hmm.
So my time in the field was mostly devoted to taking photographs of all the different aspects of the tree that I wanted to have for reference.
I had this mental picture of you sitting there on a stool in the woods looking at trees. Tell our listeners some of the really great moments you had doing that, maybe a particular tree or a bird you saw or something that just said, man, I love doing this stuff.
I'm very lucky. Yeah. I think I get to do that, and it's very pleasant to go out into the woods and sit down and work on drawing a tree or a bird. In the beginning of this project, my whole life I've been primarily a bird watcher, so it was a little bit of a challenge at the beginning to ignore the birds and focus on the trees. And there were quite a few times I'd set up my my drawing supplies somewhere to work on studying a tree, and then hear some birds singing in the distance, and pack everything up and go wandering off to chase the bird.
So, you know how birders have lists. I suspect you're a lister. Are you a lister?
Not too much.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I do it. I like to keep track of what I've seen, but I'm not a very fanatical lister.
So, are books going to sort of fall in that same category as what? Are trees rather going to fall in that same category as well for you in terms of keeping track of every tree you have actually seen?
I have started keeping a life list of trees that I've seen, and I included a list in the back of the book for that purpose, so people could easily check off the trees that they've seen. I think that it's very different from bird listing, and I don't expect it to be to catch on the way bird listing has, just because it doesn't have the same element of surprise and discovery and
elusiveness.
If somebody with birds, if somebody goes out today and sees a bird that you want to add to your list, there's a good chance that you can go look for it and it won't be there anymore.
Right. And hopefully the tree will be, right?
The tree will be.
I gotcha.
That whole element of risk is not there.
But is there a holy grail, a David Sibley tree you haven't seen yet that you want to go see?
There are quite a few. Like I said, there are quite a few species that I didn't see. Probably the one that was most frustrating to me is a species called swamp cottonwood that I think it's found in Kentucky. It's found in the Ohio and Mississippi River valleys, and it may be fairly common there. And all of my travels, I kept expecting to find it. It's in the cottonwood family, but in a separate subgenus. It's a fairly distinctive tree, and its closest relatives are in Asia. So I just kept expecting to run across it somewhere, and I never did.
Huh.
And there are even some here in Massachusetts in the Connecticut River Valley, which I never made a special trip to go see just because I kept thinking I was going to find one on my own somewhere.
Aww.
So that was one that I really wanted to see, and I just sort of was too laissez-faire about it, just expecting it to happen.
In the back of your book on trees, you have you called it an ecoregions map, 29 North American ecoregions. How did you pick them, and what's that all about?
That's a map that was created by a group of conservation organizations, just trying to define the distinctive regions from an ecological point of view in North America. And when we were searching for a map to include inside the back cover, that would have something to do with forest types and trees, and that seemed to be the best one that we could find. That it doesn't deal specifically with trees, but it does divide the continent up into regions that all share a lot of general similarities in their overall ecology.
Sure. So, David, what tree species do you think is, I guess, the most variable, so maybe the most difficult to truly identify, you know, the one that maybe confounded you the most?
Well, I guess as a group, the oaks are one of the most challenging. Mm-hmm. But there are quite a few groups of trees, genera of trees, that seem to hybridize quite a bit. And the one in particular that's well known for that is the hawthorns. Mm-hmm. And that's a genus that a lot of botanists, and I basically gave up on it in the guide.
Just because there's just too much variation and they're too promiscuous, as it were.
Yeah, they have some interesting reproductive characteristics so that they form these little localized micro species. Mm-hmm. And back around the early 1900s, a few botanists got maybe a little carried away, and they named about 1,100 species of hawthorns in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And since then, that's been whittled down, summarized, to about 100 to 200 species. But I think the consensus among botanists still seems to be that that's better, just because it's a manageable number, but it still, it doesn't really describe the variation that you see in hawthorns. So that's a group that I didn't even, well, what I did in the guide was just to present about 25 species, just to show the range of variation and to help the reader understand what a hawthorn looks like and how to identify something as a hawthorn. But if you want to identify species of hawthorns, that's really like a PhD project.
Okay.
Well, that touches on that whole what's a native tree argument that goes on now. You know, well, what's a pure native and what isn't, because they're forever out there having babies of slightly different forms.
Yeah, and the well, there are a lot of non-native trees that are spreading into the wild, and are really changing the landscape, changing the nature of the forests. Species like Ailanthus and the Royal Paulownia or Princess Tree, Norway maple up here in New England along the East Coast. So that's a big issue, but there's also an issue with native North American species that have been transplanted and cultivated and spread far beyond their actual native range.
Right.
So we have species like black locust and honey locust growing all over eastern Massachusetts here, where they're historically not native. They're native to areas a few hundred miles away, but it's a human influence that has brought them here to Massachusetts. And it's the same all over the country, that the trees that we look at now are very different from the trees that people would have seen here 100 or 200 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, David, one more question I got to ask. What's your next project? You've done birds, you've done trees, what, water, air?
Well, I'm really, I never completely got over my bird fascination, so I think my next project, I'm going to go back to birds, and I've got a couple of ideas for new bird books now, so
all right,
the next few years I'll be working on that.
Potentially, we'll see one that marries the two, birds and trees, perhaps.
Right.
Yeah, well, yes, I'll certainly do a little more attention to the trees that I paint along with the birds.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, David.
Terrific.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Birding expert David Sibley is author of The Sibley Guide to Trees. For more information on David or his books, visit the Homegrown page at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill with three questions.
Three questions. This one's from Elaine, Bob. Mm-hmm. I have a red iron cross shamrock plant, which is indoors. They got very spindly and now look as if they are dying. Is there something I can do to revive it?
Call Ratterman.
No,
it's the nature of
patience,
the beast.
Yeah.
Actually, patience, yeah. Now, you've got one in your window that doesn't do that, but that's what shamrocks will do. They'll, mm-hmm. Wintertime, they'll take a couple, 3 months off. I've got them outdoors in a sheltered spot, and they come back every year, even mm-hmm. in the ground. But mm-hmm. that's what they do, so
yeah.
not to worry.
And I think mine doesn't just because I get so much bright light in the house, but it does thin out and parts die back, but it's completely normal.
Yeah. yeah.
So it'll rebound, so just be patient.
You're okay, Elaine, not to worry.
That's right. Treat it well and be patient. Okay, here's another one, Bob. This one's from Riza. Hello, Bob and Janine. I have a question regarding a mother-in-law's tongue,
yeah.
which he hasn't planted yet. He removed it from a pot. It has a wooden root but lacks any fine, small roots. I put it in water for a few days to get those roots to grow, but a coworker said, nothing like the coworker's
yeah,
advice,
I know.
A coworker said that putting that particular plant in water could kill it. Therefore, I removed it from the water, and it's sitting out here without water and without any soil. What should he do with it?
Call a lifeguard and do CPR.
yeah, plant it.
yeah, right. yeah. They're not happy in water. They're almost impossible to kill any place except
in water.
Water, yeah.
Yeah, they're infamous for being plants that thrive on neglect.
Anything, yeah.
And honestly, I'm not really sure why you took it out of the pot, Riza, but go ahead and get it planted back into a pot with soil. Those roots, they have kind of like corms, mm-hmm. like iris do, and not a whole bunch of really fine roots, so it's just the nature of the beast. So get that potted back up, and if it's a little cattywampus, you can stake it and, you know, water it sparingly, and it should be fine, honestly. So, but just don't let it sit in water.
Or call your mother-in-law.
There you go.
One last question from John. I want to plant a tree or two in my yard and want to know if there are any fruit trees that work well in the Louisville area. Any pros and cons would be helpful.
Sure. Different kinds of apple trees that are disease resistant might be nice. Mm-hmm. I always kind of fall back on, for novice orchardists, I always fall back on the Asian pear varieties. You can get like two different trees that are going to bloom about the same time, so you get good cross-pollination, because you do need that. And they're more disease-resistant, don't
right.
you think, Bob?
Yes, they are.
And you get cleaner fruit, and it's kind of, you know, a specialty thing, so, you know, they're just easier to take care of. There's not as much pruning involved either, compared to apples, so that's one consideration. I mean, any fruit trees that you see that have good ornamental value as well as fruit?
Well, I do. There's some crab apples. I grow one called Ralph Shea. It's mm-hmm. an enormous, and you can use that for making maybe cider.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the pure apples,
yeah.
I think you covered the waterfront there.
Yeah. Okay.
Easy being the operative word.
Easy being the operative word. I would check into two different varieties of Asian pear. All right. Okay.
If you have a mother-in-law or a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246. Okay, Miss Wishy, the Latin word of the week just reminds me of the woods.
Good. I'm being consistent here, aren't
you
I?
You are, yeah.
All right, the Latin word of the week this week is Sylvatica or Sylvaticus, and it means growing in the woods, forest-loving, or wild.
Yep.
So, kind of Sylvan, yes?
It's a fairly common
word.
In the tree world. Anyway.
Which makes sense, doesn't
yeah.
it? All right, Nyssa sylvatica is the black gum.
Yeah, great tree.
Fagus sylvatica.
The European beech.
European beech. Esculus sylvatica.
The painted buckeye. I'm curious about that one.
You know, the painted buckeye, it's going to be a colonizing sort of, you know, low-growth shrub
yeah.
in the woods, right?
Shade
so this
lover.
Whole like growing in the woods is going to suggest an understory tree often mm-hmm. Or something that enjoys a little bit of shade. Carex sylvatica.
The woodland sedge.
Woodland sedge.
Yeah.
How about that for a grassy component
Perfect.
In a shade garden?
Yeah.
Artemisia sylvatica.
Hard to say. The woodland wormwood.
Myosotis sylvaticus.
Oh boy, the woodland forget-me-not.
Woodland forget-me-not.
Impossible to forget.
Senecio sylvaticus.
The woodland ragwort.
Woodland ragwort. So if you see sylvatica or sylvaticus, something will be growing in the woods. It's forest loving, wild, sort of suggests understory or shade loving.
Buy it,
exactly. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, navigating the cultural landscape and the homes and gardens of the DuPont family.
Homegrown is produced by the WFPL wild man, Brad Yost, in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.